2016 is going to be a huge year.
Okay.
Seth, the problem is that they've made it now that a city can't go and individually raise the minimum wage to 15.
There's a
statewide preemption that prevents it. The state has to do it. And that's what we were talking about with Senate Bill 332 and House Bill 2009. You got to call your legislator and let them know that you support a $15 minimum wage. And also, if you are going to call and talk to them, let them know that everybody deserves some paid sick time. It's just heartbreaking to know that somebody has to go to work when they're sick or their little kid is sick, and they got to make a decision between being able to pay the rent or being able to take care of themselves or their children.
Well, and again, this speaks to corporate common sense, corporate intelligence. You know how many billions of dollars are lost from sick time? People going to work, we don't have sick days. Let's go to work. And we make everybody else sick. And then they're losing weeks and months of man hours because they don't do sick time.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's in their own interest, again, to have this, you know, if I don't want to go, I don't want to go to work when I'm sick. But I don't have sick days, so guess what? I go, and I'm coughing all over people, and they're complaining about it. And you know what? Hey, I've told people, sorry, it's too bad. I don't get sick days.
That's right. Well, I guess that's just about all the time that we have for tonight. Tammy and Seth, thanks for coming down.
No problem.
Thank you.
Michael, as always, I'm glad that you're here with me.
Thank you for having me, as always.
And for everyone out there that's listening, thanks for listening, and keep up the battle. We're gonna fight to make Oregon a better place to work and live.
Amen.
Yeah.
Have a good night.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Frankie and Johnny were sweethearts. At least that's the way the story goes.
Tune in to KABU Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. for another broadcast from the STEAM Radio Syndicate, performing live from a tugboat in the Willamette River. Their focus this time is the Ballad of Frankie and Johnny.
He was her man, but he done her wrong.
Again, that's the STEAM Radio Syndicate, Monday, February 16th at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This story has no morrow. This story has no end. This story just goes to show that there ain't no good in men. He was a man, and he done a wrong.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. Disability Rights Oregon is an organization that works to uphold the legal rights of people with disabilities. Disability Rights Oregon will introduce a bill that will stop solitary confinement for persons with serious mental illness incarcerated in Oregon prisons. My guest is Bob Joondeff, Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
So give us a little background about yourself and Disability Rights Oregon.
Disability Rights Oregon is a federally funded nonprofit, and we get money to advocate on behalf of people with disabilities to enforce their rights across the state. And that includes people in institutions such as state hospitals, prisons, jails, group homes, et cetera. So a part of the work that we've always done has been investigating complaints of abuse or neglect of prisoners who have disabilities, particularly psychiatric disabilities. I got involved with this many, many years ago. I had started in Oregon as a VISTA volunteer lawyer in the Klamath County Legal Aid Office, worked my way around the state in various legal aid offices, worked as a public defender, and ultimately got into working in civil rights issues for people with disabilities.
So let's get right to it. The bill is to stop solitary confinement in Oregon prisons for persons with serious mental illness. Why this bill and why now, Bob?
Well, Karen, the question of putting people with mental illness in solitary confinement is one that's been with us ever since there's been prisons. And as we've developed our knowledge of mental illness and how it affects people, we've come to realize that keeping people alone without any contact with other people or any other type of stimulation can be particularly harmful to the mental illness that people are experiencing. And so over the years, we've worked, and people have worked across the country, to try to minimize the amount of time that people with mental illness spend in prison. So part of that is just understanding whether or not an inmate has mental illness. So many people are aware of the fact that our jails and prisons have become the largest mental institutions in most states. In the Oregon penitentiary system, they do screenings when inmates come in, new inmates come into the system. And if they note a mental illness of some sort, they rank the severity of that illness. And so in the prison population, generally speaking, over 30% of the inmates have some sort of mental health label. And that's apart from chemical dependency issues. And about 6% of those people have severe and persistent, what are called severe and persistent mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, major depression. And for those inmates, prison is a terrible environment. It is a non-therapeutic to say the least, environment. I mean, it's not an enjoyable place for anyone to be, but if you happen to have a psychiatric problem, the type of confinement, the type of pressure and anxiety that's produced by being in a prison environment makes handling the mental health issues much more difficult. And usually what that means is that if a person's having difficulty, it's going to present itself in terms of behavior. It can be violent behavior. It can be self-injurious behavior and just difficulty in following rules and getting along. So Oregon has recognized these problems. Many years ago, over 10 years ago, I sat on a task force in the prison system to work on what's the best way to manage folks with mental illness in that system. At that time, the head of the Department of Corrections, Max Williams, was very dedicated to this issue, and a plan was put together that it included screening up front of inmates and getting inmates to appropriate levels of housing and oversight. And in a way, what we talked about at that time was creating a mental health system in the prison system that mirrored the community so that there were people who could live in general population in the prison and get the equivalent of outpatient mental health services. There are people who needed special housing. And then there was people who needed more observation and custody, sort of along the lines of a mental hospital. What's happened over time is that because of lack of funding to put some of the plans into place and lack of adequate physical structure, buildings, to do what needs to be done, people, particularly with the more severe mental illnesses, have ended up all too often in confinement because of behaviors that are the result of their mental illnesses, confinement that keeps them in cells for long periods of time without stimulation, without natural light, without exercise, without access to therapy on a regular basis. And that's harmful for them. And when it's harmful for them, it's harmful for everyone. Just like untreated mental illness in the community, if it's untreated, it can be harmful not only for that individual, but their family and their community. The problem, of course, is that in that very unnatural prison environment, the response to behaviors is oftentimes more and more punishment, more and more confinement. People who work as security guards are afraid of injury. They're afraid of attack. And there can be a response to folks who are prisoners that just becomes more and more punitive. That can happen. So the challenge is to, for folks who have identified as having the major mental illnesses particularly, is to make sure that approaches to handling their behavior are therapeutically directed. And by doing that, we have a number of proposals that are designed to minimize the chance that a person is made worse and give them an opportunity to have their mental illnesses treated rather than punished.
And I would like to preface all of this by saying it is my belief that we should not be incarcerating people with mental illness at all. So, Bob, you said a few things, that 30% of people have some type of mental or emotional issue who are locked up in Oregon prisons. You know, the ODOC website claims over 50%. And some people believe that is even higher, people with mental illness, and we're not even talking about addictions as well. Also, you know, people, when they do go to Coffee Creek, and that is the intake prison for all prisoners entering the Oregon prison system, a lot of people probably don't report as having mental issues because they are immediately stigmatized and they don't want to be labeled within the prison system. Do you find that as well?
Yes, there is stigma throughout society against mental illness, and prison is no different. And that's not only among the inmates, but also among the people who work there. I was going to note earlier that prison officials will tell you that the lifespan of a person who works as a prison guard can be as much as 20 years shorter than the average citizen. The fact of the matter is that prisons are very unnatural environments. They're very high stress environments. People who are in them, whether they're inmates or staff, are at hyper alert at all times because of the nature of the facility. And so what we have done is that we've created environments that are inherently unhealthy and highly stressful, where people are subject to injury, both mental and physical. And so what I like to say is that if you don't have a mental illness before you go into prison, you're likely to have one by the time you get out. And we just have to understand that this is a choice that we've made as a society as our way to confine people who have committed crimes. And this isn't to minimize the nature of some of those crimes. It's just to say that the way that we've chosen to keep people safe is not particularly effective. This shows up significantly with people with mental illness because they are almost by definition more subject to stress, more subject to the negative effects of isolation, and more prone to injury as a result of addressing behaviors that they cannot control themselves. So yeah, I completely agree that people with mental illness should not be in that environment, We're dealing with a complicated problem in that many people who come into that system also have related drug and alcohol issues, some of which are a result of self-medication due to feeling depressed or having some sort of lack of control in their lives that's the result of childhood or experiences in youth. And some people are critical of prison because they think it's kind of a free ride or a luxury environment. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's a environment in which it's one of deprivation. It's one of isolation, particularly if a person is experiencing those already. The other factor that the professionals who work there will tell you is that there's probably an enormous amount of undiagnosed brain injury and post-traumatic stress just due to the lifestyle that many people have before they come into prison. But the prison officials don't have an effective way of screening that. And when you have even low-level brain injuries, if you think about the discussions around pro football, we're right after the Super Bowl, but brain injury tends to have an effect of not only loss of some memory, but also loss of some impulse control. And that, if you can imagine, when you're in a very structured environment where you have to follow the rules and behave yourself, that can lead to more and more discipline, and that can lead to more and more isolation, and that isolation can be particularly harmful for a person who is having trouble controlling their own emotions.
So why not stop solitary confinement for people across the board? I realize Disability Rights Oregon focuses on persons with mental illness and disabilities, but why not stop solitary confinement, period?
Well, I'm certainly not here to argue against that. There is a nationwide movement right now regarding the use of isolation of youth in correctional facilities. In Oregon, we have the Oregon Youth Authority that has a number of institutions around the state. And the question is isolation inherently harmful for young people? And the new science that I'm aware of is showing that, yes, it is particularly harmful for young people. And again, because they're more susceptible to what can be deemed this type of psychological stress, they're more likely to experience psychological pain, up to hallucinations, and it can make feelings of self-loathing and desire to self-harm, even suicide, increase significantly. And I'm aware in some states where they've moved to banning isolation for children who have a mental health diagnosis. In Oregon, by the way, speaking of statistics, the Oregon Youth Authority will tell you that over 70% of the youth in their facilities have some significant mental health diagnosis. And the plan is, even in those states that have already banned it, to expand that to the entire population. Isolation has been used so long for both youth and adults that changing how you do things, it takes training and it takes work in identifying problems up front and dealing with them in a more therapeutic way. And bringing that training into security staff can be challenging. But one thing about Oregon is that, well, I think Oregon probably has a decent record in terms of its use of isolation. It doesn't have hard and fast rules around it. And so that means that in situations in which isolation is used, the length of that isolation isn't governed by law. It's governed by practice in those institutions. So that's something that needs to be looked at. I wanted to be clear also that isolation is generally condoned on a very short-term basis when there's a violent situation. Once the violence is occurring, there may be a need to get somebody out of that violent situation, but that isolation should never go on for more than say 2 hours maximum.
So Oregon does not have the SHUs, the security housing units, as they do in Pelican Bay and Corcoran, where they went on hunger strikes in 2013 and earlier years to bring it international attention to the issue of solitary confinement. We don't do that here in Oregon.
That is correct. I've worked with corrections personnel for many years, and they'll tell you that the approach taken in California, which is not to interact with inmates, to keep a very strict divide between inmates and corrections personnel, that philosophy isn't used in Oregon. There's an encouragement to interact with inmates, and there's an encouragement to make sure that inmates have some sort of connection to stimulus.
How long are they locked in when they're in solitary confinement here in Oregon?
Well, again, there's different types of isolation in Oregon. There's different units that are specifically for isolation. There's disciplinary segregation and there's administrative segregation. There's a unit that's called the intensive management unit, that is single cell unit. But the corrections personnel don't consider that last one to be solitary because people can hear each other and there's some form of interaction that people can have. When you get down into the weeds and some of this stuff, people will disagree about what constitutes solitary isolation. From our perspective, solitary isolation is when a person is sitting in a cell for hours and hours on end without any activity, without anything to keep them occupied. And our strongest concern is about something called the behavioral management unit at the penitentiary, because that's where a person will end up if they have a major mental disorder and they have behavioral problems. And in that unit, it's dark, it's single cell occupancy people can have very few items in their cells with them because they have to be shackled and have two guards escort them in order to go to therapy appointments. Their therapy appointments can be as little as 1 hour a week, whereas most experts would agree that people should have 5 hours a day.
And how long are they locked in that cell? For what length of time?
Well, a person could be in that unit for years. In terms of being locked in the cell, it depends upon their individual status. Some people can remain in their cells as many as 23 hours a day, only getting out. They generally have an opportunity to shower, but they can refuse. And if a person's sick, they may be refusing any contact. If a person has been throwing bodily waste, which is something that can happen in a prison, they'll put translucent plastic over the front of the cell. So the cell is basically a 8x10 space that is totally confined without being able to see out. Of course, there is a television on the wall outside, but if you've got plastic up, you're not going to see that. So you're pretty much in there by yourself without very much to do. And again, what our bill would mandate and what we think is best practice right now is that people are engaged either in therapy or some sort of non-therapeutic activity outside their cell 7 hours a day. And that we think is a bottom line for humane custody, particularly for a person with a serious mental illness.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James with my guest, Bob Joondeff, Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And Bob, does this cover county jails as well as the Oregon prison system? Because this is occurring in our county jails also.
No, this bill would only cover the prison system. And prison is for folks who have been convicted of a crime that is a felony, so a serious crime. Jails generally house people who are awaiting a trial or have been convicted of a misdemeanor, something that would have a maximum of 1 year.
It still could mean that they're experiencing a mental health crisis in that environment for months at a time.
That is correct. And jails are very different depending upon where you are in the state. Some jails have better mental health services. Some have virtually no mental health services. Some restrict the types of medications that inmates can have. And the jails are the responsibility of each county. So you get a wide variety of care. The other thing that's particularly troubling is that some people who end up in jail are so disordered that they can't help or assist their attorney in defending their case, and they can sit in jail for literally months awaiting an evaluation of their mental health status and then a finding of whether they can help their attorney. Once they're found unable to assist their attorney, they have a right to get treatment within a week.
And that is not occurring.
That's actually the result of a lawsuit that our organization brought many years ago that put that cap on there. And sometimes it's not honored. Most of the time, I think it is. But the real problem is in getting people their evaluations and then getting the court to make a decision based upon that evaluation.
So let's talk about what types of infractions can get a person in solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement is a disciplinary, usually a disciplinary matter. So if a person speaks inappropriately, is aggressive, is threatening aggression, even self-harm, so threatening or acting out on harm against staff, other inmates, or themselves, can result in isolation.
And often what I hear are minor infractions or behaviors that are a direct result of people's mental illness, such as being paranoid and not wanting to go back into their cell, so they're thrown in solitary confinement. I had a loved one with mental illness who refused to sign a shower sheet and was thrown in solitary confinement for a week at a time. And I'd like to let people know that they can call the prison and let the prison know that these behaviors are a result of their mental illness.
I agree completely. One of the most important things for a person entering into the prison system is that the prison has adequate records about the person, the inmate's health and mental health background and chemical dependency background. When a person first gets sent to prison, they get sent to the Coffee Creek Institution where they go through a battery of evaluations. They would like to have medical records so that they can do a good evaluation, and but sometimes they don't get them. Oftentimes they don't get what they need. So very important for them to get them. Now, there are confidentiality issues around medical matters. One thing for families and friends to understand is that whatever they have to tell the prison personnel, the medical personnel, that's not confidential information. The confidentiality attaches in the other direction, so that if the person wants to know medical information about the inmate, that's something that unless the inmate would agree to that, the prison shouldn't be sharing. But information flow in the other direction is fine. The other thing I'd say that's very important, and this is true for any person in any type of institution, is that being aware of what's happening with the person, letting the administration and the staff know that you care, that you want information, that you're watching, makes a huge difference. Because when we talk about isolation, not only is isolation in a cell destructive, but being removed from society and not having anyone outside of that world looking in can be dangerous as well. So the term squeaky wheel gets the grease is very true in any institutional setting.
And Bob, does it help that the United Nations calls solitary confinement torture?
Well, it's an important recognition that this form of punishment is destructive. And I think that any prison or administration should be evaluating that and making decisions about what's the best way to maintain discipline in an institution.
Bob, in your proposed legislation, you talk about a cool-down period to allow an inmate an opportunity to comply with the prison employee's orders. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, oftentimes, stress can peak during a period of confrontation or violence. And this can be a situation that occurs in any area where there's discipline involved or confrontation with authority. And if you compare it to what's going on right now in the city of Portland with police training to try to de-escalate confrontive situations rather than put hands on and take a person to the ground, that there's a recognition that particularly if a person has a mental illness, that violent intervention can lead you to harm and having to take people to jail who don't need to be taken to jail. The same thing is true in the correction setting, that when tempers flare, when mental illness gets triggered, that if everyone is aware that a person has a diagnosis, that rather than now move towards physical intervention and isolation, it might be a good time to bring in a therapist to try to calm down the situation and find a better way to go. And that's what, for this particular group of people, we think is the best practice and can result in less violence, less injury, and more humane treatment. The second piece of that is that use of force is in a prison is oftentimes used to get inmates to follow certain directions. One of the things that can happen in prison is called a cell extraction, and this is when an inmate refuses to come out of their cell. And what will happen in those situations is that after enough warning, the staff will put on riot gear, have huge shields, and open the door and go in and drag the person out.
And how frightening is that for a person with a mental illness?
Well, most of the tragedies that we've had to respond to and investigate since we've been working in the prisons have been cell extractions that have gone wrong. We had out in Eastern Oregon, in one of the prisons, we had a man who died during a cell extraction, had a major mental illness. We've had the use of overuse of chemical agents on inmates, and that's like pepper spray. They have something called pepper ball guns, or where they fire plastic pellets containing pepper substance.
And your proposed legislation addresses use of chemicals also.
Yeah, and again, this is as a result of our experience in when things have just gotten out of hand. And, you know, we're not saying that this is what happens every time or most of the time, but it can get out of hand by nature of violence. And an example of that is this man who, in New York City, when the police officer used the chokehold on the man. I'm sure that officer did not intend to kill the fellow, but when you get into a violent situation, anything can happen. And so it's really important to try to avoid that.
When someone's screaming, I can't breathe.
And in fact, the case that we handled out in Eastern Oregon, that's exactly what happened. It was very similar. Man couldn't breathe. And
I'm speaking with Bob Jundiff, Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. You have proposed legislation to stop solitary confinement in Oregon prisons for persons with serious mental illness. Do you have any sponsors for this bill?
Senator Chip Shields is helping us with this bill. He's very supportive. We're looking for other sponsors. And we feel that the standards that we're offering are best practice. And we think that there are things that the Department of Corrections can do. Our Oregon.org. We have ongoing news about legislation on our website that affects people with disabilities, including this bill. Any further information, people can contact me at our office, 503-243-2081. The attorneys in our office who are working on this issue are Sarah Radcliffe and Joel Greenberg, and they would be happy to hear from anyone who's concerned. One of the wonderful things about Oregon is that we have a very open legislative process, and legisl-